that I was decently dressed. My father came round at the end of the first month and wanted all my wages, but I could only give him a quarter, having spent the rest, and then he began to curse and swear and seized me by the arm, but Mary set the stable hands on to him. And he came back at the end of the second month, and I gave him a quarter again, and Mary told him he wasn't to come any more, and he called her hard names, and she called him worse, and whistled for the men, and so he was chased off. I was of two minds about this, as I felt sorry for the little ones, and I tried to send them some money afterwards through Mrs. Burt, but I do not think they received it. I was set to work at first as a scullery maid, scouring out the pots and pans, but it was soon observed that the iron cauldrons were too heavy for me, and then our laundress left for a new position, and another one came who was not so brisk, and Mrs. Honey said I was to assist Mary with the rinsing and the wringing out, and the hanging up, and the folding, and the mangling, and the mending, and we were both very pleased. Mary said she would teach me what I needed to know, and as I was bright enough, I would learn it quickly. When I would make a mistake and become anxious about it, Mary would comfort me and say I should not take things so seriously, and if you never made a mistake, you would never learn. And when Mrs. Honey spoke sharply to me and I was on the verge of tears, Mary would say I should not mind her, as that was her way. It was because she had swallowed a bottle of vinegar and it came out on her tongue. And also I should remember that we were not slaves, and being a servant was not a thing we were born to, nor would we be forced to continue at it forever. It was just a job of work. She said it was the custom for young girls in this country to hire themselves out in order to earn the money for their dowries, and then they would marry, and if their husbands prospered, they would soon be hiring their own servants in their turn, at the very least a maid of all work, and that one day I would be the mistress of a tidy farmhouse and independent, and I would look back on my trials and tribulations at the hand of Mrs. Honey as a fine joke. And one person was as good as the next, and on this side of the ocean folks rose in the world by hard work, not by who their grandfather was. And that was the way it should be. She said that being a servant was like anything else. There was a knack to it which many never learned, and it was all in the way of looking at it. For instance, we'd been told always to use the back stairs in order to keep out of the way of the family, but in truth it was the other way around. The front stairs were there so the family could keep out of our way. They could go traipsing up and down the front stairs in their fancy clothes and trinkets, while the real work of the place went on behind their backs, without them getting all snarled up in it and interfering and making a nuisance of themselves. They were feeble and ignorant creatures, although rich, and most of them could not light a fire if their toes were freezing off, because they didn't know how. And it was a wonder they could blow their own noses or wipe their own backsides. They were by their nature as useless as a prick on a priest, if you'll excuse me, sir, but that was how she put it. And if they were to lose all their money tomorrow and be thrown out on the streets, they would not even be able to make a living by honest whoring, as they would not know which part was to go in where, and they would end up getting, I won't say the word, in the ear. And most of them did not know their own arse from a hole in the ground. And she said something else about the women, which was so coarse I will not repeat it, sir, but it made us laugh very much. She said that the trick to it was to have the work done without it ever being seen to be done. And if any of them was to surprise you at a task, you should simply remove yourself at once. In the end, she said, we had the better of them because we washed their dirty linen, and therefore we knew a good deal about them. But they did not wash ours, and knew nothing about us at all. There were few secrets they could keep from the servants, and if I was ever to be a chambermaid, I would have to learn to carry a bucketful of filth as if it was a bowl of roses. For the thing these people hated the most was to be reminded that they, too, had bodies, and their shit stank as much as anyone else's, if not worse. And then she would say a poem. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? As I've said, sir, Mary was an outspoken young woman and did not mince words, and she had very democratic ideas, which it took me some getting used to. At the very top of the house was a large attic, divided up, and if you climbed the stairs and went along past the room where we slept and down some other stairs, you were in the drying room. It was strung with lines and had several small windows that opened out under the eaves, and the chimney from the kitchen ran up through this room. It was used to dry the clothes in winter, and when it was raining outside. As a rule, we did not do a wash if the weather threatened, but especially in the summer the day could start fair and then cloud over all of a sudden, and thunder and rain. And the thunderstorms were very violent, with loud cracks of thunder and fiery flashes of lightning, so much that you would think the end of the world was come. I was terrified the first time it happened, and got under a table and began to cry. And Mary said it was nothing, only a thunderstorm. But then she told me several stories of men who had been out in their fields, or even in the barns, and were struck dead by lightning, and also a cow standing under a tree. When we had a wash hanging out and the first drops began to fall, we would rush out with the baskets and gather all in as quickly as we could, and then haul it up the stairs and hang it out anew in the drying room, as it could not be allowed to sit in the baskets for long because of mildew. I did love the smell of a laundry dried outside. It was a good fresh smell, and the shirts and the nightgowns flapping in the breeze on a sunny day were like large white birds or angels rejoicing, although without any heads. But when we hung the same things up inside, in the grey twilight of the drying room, they looked different, like pale ghosts of themselves hovering and shimmering there in the gloom. And the look of them, so silent and bodiless, made me afraid. And Mary, who was very quick in such matters, soon found this out, and would hide behind the sheets and press up against them so there was the outline of her face, and give out a moaning sound. Or she would get behind the nightshirts and make their arms move. Her object was to frighten me, and she would succeed, and I would shriek. And then we would chase up and down between the rows of washing, laughing and screaming, but trying not to laugh and scream too loud. And if I would catch her, I would dart in and tickle her, for she was very ticklish. And sometimes we would try on Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's corsets over top of our clothes, and walk around with our chests sticking out and looking down our noses. And we would be so overcome that we would fall backwards into the baskets of linens and lie there gasping like fish until we'd recovered our straight faces again. These were just high spirits of youth, which do not always take a very dignified form, as I'm sure you have had cause to observe, sir. Mrs. Alderman Parkinson had more pieced quilts than I'd ever seen before in my life, as it was not so much the fashion on the other side of the ocean, and printed cottons were not so cheap and plentiful. Mary said that a girl did not consider herself ready for marriage here until she had three such quilts made by her own hands, and the fanciest ones were the marriage quilts, such as the Tree of Paradise and the Flower Basket. Others, such as the Wild Goose Chase and the Pandora's Box, had a good many pieces and took skill. And those, such as the Log Cabin and the Nine Patch, were for every day and were much faster to make. Mary had not begun on her own marriage quilt yet, as she did not have the time, being a servant, but she'd already finished a nine patch. On a fine day in mid-September, Mrs. Honey said it was time to take out the winter quilts and blankets, and to air them in preparation for the cold weather, and to mend the rents and tears, and she gave this task to Mary and myself. The quilts were stored in the attic, away from the drying room, to avoid the damp, in a cedar chest, with a sheet of muslin in between each one and enough camphor to kill a cat, and the smell of it made me quite light-headed. We were to carry them downstairs and hang them out on the lines, and brush them down and see if the moths had been at them, for sometimes, despite cedar chests and camphor, the moths would get in, and the winter quilts had wool bats inside them instead of the cotton ones in the summer quilts. The winter quilts were of deeper colors than the summer ones, with reds and oranges and blues and purples, and some of them had silks and velvets and brocade pieces in them. Over the years in prison, when I've been by myself, as I am a good deal of the time, I've closed my eyes and turned my head towards the sun, and I've seen a red and an orange that were like the brightness of those quilts. And when we'd hung a half a dozen of them on the line all in a row, I thought they looked like flags, hung out by an army as it goes to war. And since that time I have thought, why is it that women have chosen to sew such flags, and then lay them on the tops of beds? For they make the bed the most noticeable thing in a room, and then I have thought, it's for a warning. Because you may think a bed is a peaceful thing, sir, and to you it may mean rest and comfort, and a good night's sleep. But it isn't so for everyone, and there are many dangerous things that may take place in a bed. It is where we are born, and that is our first peril in life, and it is where women give birth, which is often their last. And it is where the act takes place between men and women that I will not mention to you, sir, but I suppose you know what it is. And some call it love, and others despair, or else merely an indignity which they must suffer through. And finally beds are what we sleep in, and where we dream, and often where we die. But I did not have these fancies about the quilts until after I was already in prison. It is a place where you have a lot of time to think, and no one to tell your thoughts to, and so you tell them to yourself. Here, Dr. Jordan asks me to pause a little so he can catch up with his writing, for he says he's much interested in what I have just related. I'm glad of this, as I've enjoyed telling about those days, and if I had my own wish, I would stay in them as long as I could. So I wait, and watch his hand moving over the paper, and think it must be pleasant to have the knack of writing so quickly, which can only be done by practice, like playing the piano. And I wonder if he has a good singing voice, and sings duets with young ladies in the evenings when I am shut up alone in my cell. Most likely he does, as he is handsome enough and friendly and unmarried. "And so, Grace," he says, looking up, "you consider a bed to be a dangerous place." There is a different note in his voice. Perhaps he is laughing at me up his sleeve. I should not speak to him so freely, and decide I will not if that is the tone he is going to take. "Well, of course not every time you get into it, sir," I say, "only on those occasions which I have mentioned." Then I keep silent and continue to sew. "Have I offended you somehow, Grace?" he says. "I did not intend to." I sew in silence for a few moments more. Then I say, "I will believe you, sir, and take you at your word, and hope such will be returned in future." "Of course, of course," he says warmly. "Please do go on with your story. I should not have interrupted." "Surely you do not want to hear about such ordinary things in daily life," I say. "I want to hear anything you may tell me, Grace," he says. "The small details of life often hide a great significance." I am not certain what he means by that, but I continue. At last we had all of the quilts carried down and hung out in the sun and brushed, and we took two of them inside again to mend them. We stayed in the laundry where there was no washing going forward, so it was cooler than the attic, and there was a large table where we could spread the quilts out. One of them was quite strange-looking. It had four grey urns with four green willow trees growing out of them, and a white dove in each corner, or I believe they were intended for doves, although they looked more like chickens. And in the middle was a woman's name embroidered in black, Flora. And Mary said it was a memorial quilt, done by Mrs. Alderman Parkinson in the memory of a dear departed friend, as was then becoming the fashion. And the other quilt was called Attic Windows. It had a great many pieces, and if you looked at it one way, it was closed boxes, and when you looked at it another way, the boxes were open, and I suppose the closed boxes were the attics, and the open ones were the windows. And that is the same with all quilts. You can see them two different ways by looking at the dark pieces, or else the light. But when Mary said the name, I did not hear it right, and I thought she said Attic Widows. And I said, "Attic Widows, that's a very odd name for a bed quilt." And then Mary told me what the right name was, and we had a fit of laughing because we pictured an attic all full of widows in their black dresses with their widow's caps and the weepers hanging down, pulling mournful faces and wringing their hands and writing letters on their black-bordered writing paper and dabbing at their eyes with their black-bordered handkerchiefs. And Mary said, "And the boxes and chests in the attic would be all stuffed to the brim with their dear deceased husbands' cut-off hair." And I said, "And perhaps the dear deceased husbands are in the chests, too." And that set us off again. We could not stop laughing, even when we heard Mrs. Honey and her keys clanking along the hall. We buried our faces against the quilts, and by the time she'd opened the door, Mary was composed again. But I was face down with my shoulders heaving, and Mrs. Honey said, "What is the matter, girls?" And Mary stood up and said, "Please, Mrs. Honey, it's just that Grace is crying about her dead mother." And Mrs. Honey said, "Very well, then. You may take her down to the kitchen for a cup of tea, but don't be too long about it." And she said that young girls were often weepy, but Mary must not indulge me and let it get out of control. And when she'd gone out, we held on to each other and laughed so much I thought we should die. Now, you may think it very thoughtless in us, sir, to have made light of widows. And with the deaths in my own family, I should have known it was not a thing to joke over. And if there had been any widows nearby, we would never have done it. as it is wrong to make fun of another's suffering. But there were no widows to hear us, and all I can say, sir, is that we were young girls. And young girls are often silly in that way, and it is better to laugh than burst. Then I thought about widows' humps and widows' walks, and the widow's mite in the Bible, which we servants were always being urged to give to the poor out of our wages. And also I thought about how the men would wink and nod when a young and rich widow was mentioned, and how a widow was a respectable thing to be, if old and poor, but not otherwise, which is quite strange when you come to consider it. In September the weather was beautiful, with days just like summer, and then in October many of the trees turned red and yellow and orange as if they were on fire, and I could never stop looking at them. And one afternoon towards evening I was outside with Mary gathering the sheets from the lines, and we heard a sound like many hoarse voices calling together. And Mary said, "Look up, it's the wild geese flying south for the winter." The sky above was dark with them, and Mary said, "The hunters will be out tomorrow morning." And it was sad to think that these wild creatures were about to be shot. One night in late October a frightening thing happened to me. I would not tell you about this, sir, except that you are a doctor, and doctors know about it already, so you will not be shocked. I had been using the chamber pot, as I was already in my nightdress and ready to go to bed, so did not want to go outside to the privy in the dark, and when I happened to look down, there was blood, and some on my nightdress also. I was bleeding from between the legs, and I thought I was dying, and burst into tears. Mary, coming into the room, found me in this state and said, "What has happened?" And I said that I had a dreadful illness and would surely die, and I had a pain in my stomach as well, which I'd ignored, thinking it was only from eating too much new bread, as it was a baking day. But now I remembered my mother, and how her death had begun with a stomach pain, and I cried harder. Mary looked, and to do her credit she did not laugh at me, but explained all. You will wonder that I did not know this, considering how many children my mother had given birth to. But the fact is that I knew about babies and how they got out, and even how they got in, having seen dogs in the street, but not this other thing. I'd had no friends my own age, or I suppose I would have learnt it. And Mary said, "You are a woman now," which made me cry again. But she put her arms around me and comforted me, better than my own mother could have done, for she was always too busy or tired or ill. Then she lent me her red flannel petticoat until I should get one of my own, and showed me how to fold and pin the cloths, and said that some called it Eve's curse, but she thought that was stupid, and the real curse of Eve was having to put up with the nonsense of Adam, who, as soon as there was any trouble, blamed it all on her. She also said that if the pain got too bad, she would get me some willow bark to chew, and that would help. And she would heat a brick for me on the kitchen stove and wrap it in a towel, for the ache. And I was very grateful to her, for she was indeed a good and kind friend. And then she sat me down and combed out my hair, which was gentle and soothing, and she said, "Grace, you will be a beauty, and soon you will turn the men's heads. The worst ones are the gentlemen, who think they are entitled to anything they want, and when you go out to the privy at night, they're drunk then. They lie in wait for you, and then it is snatch and grab. There's no reasoning with them. And if you must, you should give them a kick between the legs where they'll feel it. And it is always better to lock your door and to use the chamber pot. But any kind of man will try the same, and they'll start promising things. They'll say they will do whatever you want. But you must be very careful what you ask, and you must never do anything for them until they have performed what they promised. And if there's a ring, there must be a parson to go with it." I asked her innocently, "Why was that?" And she said, "It was because men were liars by nature and would say anything to get what they wanted of you, and then they would think better of it and be off on the next boat." And now I saw that we were in the same story as the one Aunt Pauline used to tell about my mother, and I nodded wisely and said that she was right, although still not altogether certain what she meant. And she gave me a hug and said I was a good girl. On the night of October the 31st, which, as you know, sir, is All Hallows' Eve, when they say the spirits of the dead come back from the grave, although it is only a superstition, On that night, Mary came to our room with something hidden in her apron, and she said, "Look, I have got us 4 apples. I baked them from cook." Apples were plentiful at that time of year, and there were barrels of them already stored in the cellar. "Oh," I said, "are they for us to eat?" And she said, "We will eat them after, but this is the night when you can find out who you will marry." She said she had got 4 so that we would each have 2 chances at it. She showed me a little knife she'd got from cook also, or so she said. The truth is that she sometimes took things without asking, which made me nervous, though she said it was not stealing as long as you put the things back after. But sometimes she didn't do that either. She'd taken a copy of The Lady of the Lake by Sir Walter Scott out of the library where they had 5 of them, and she was reading it out loud to me. And she had a store of candle ends, which she'd taken 1 by 1 from the dining room, and she kept them hidden under a loose floorboard, and if she'd had them by permission, she wouldn't have done so. We were allowed our own candle to undress by at night, but Mrs. Honey said we weren't to burn it up in a profligate way. Each candle was to last us a week, and that was less light than Mary wanted to have. She had some lucifer matches, which she also kept hidden, so that when our official candle was blown out to save it, she could light another one whenever she wanted, and she lit 2 of her candle ends now. "Here is the knife and the apple," she said, "and you must take the peel off in 1 long piece, and then without looking behind you, you must throw it over your left shoulder, and it will spell out the initial of the man you will marry, and tonight you will dream about him." I was too young to be thinking of husbands, but Mary talked about them a great deal. When she'd saved up enough of her wages, she was going to marry a nice young farmer whose land was already cleared and a good house built. And if she could not get one of those, she would settle for one with a log house, and they would build a better house later. She even knew what kind of hens and cow they would have. She wanted white and red leghorns and a Jersey cow for the cream and cheese, which she said there was nothing better. So I took the apple and pared it, and I got the peel off in 1 piece. Then I threw it behind me, and we looked at how it had fallen. There was no telling which way was up, but at last we decided that it was a J, and Mary began to tease, and to tell over the names of the men she knew whose names began with a J, and she said I would marry Jim from the stables, who had a squint and stank horribly, or else Jeremiah the peddler, who was much handsomer, though I would have had to tramp the country and would have no house but the pack I carried on my back like a snail. And she said I would cross water 3 times before it happened, and I said she was inventing it. And she smiled, because I'd guessed she was tricking me. Then it was her turn, and she began to peel. But the peel on her first apple broke, and also on the second, so I gave her my extra one. But she was so nervous that she cut it in 2 almost as soon as she'd begun. And then she laughed and said it was only a foolish old wife's tale. And she ate the 3rd apple and set the other 2 on the window ledge to keep until the morning, and I ate my own apple, and we turned to making fun of Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's corsets. But underneath all the funning she was upset. And when we went to bed I could tell that she hadn't gone to sleep, but was lying on her back beside me staring up at the ceiling. And when I did go to sleep myself I did not dream of husbands at all. Instead I dreamt of my mother in her winding sheet, drifting down through the cold water, which was blue-green in color, and the sheet began to come undone at the top, and it waved as if in the wind, and her hair floated out, rippling like seaweed, but the hair was over her face, so I could not see it, and it was darker than my mother's hair had been, and then I knew that this was not my mother at all, but some other woman, and she was not dead inside the sheet at all, but still alive. And I was afraid, and I woke up with my heart beating very fast, and the cold sweat on me. But Mary was asleep now, breathing deeply, and the gray and pink light of the dawn was beginning, and outside the cocks had begun to crow, and all was as usual. And so I felt better. And so things went on through November, when the leaves fell from the trees and it became dark early, and the weather was grim and gray, with a hard, driving rain. And then December came, and the ground froze up solid as a rock, and there were flurries of snow. Our attic room was now very cold, especially in the mornings, when we had to get up in the dark and put our bare feet on the icy floorboards. And Mary said that when she had a house of her own, she would have a braided rag rug beside every bed, and she herself would have a pair of warm felt slippers. We took our clothes into the bed with us to warm them up before putting them on, and dressed underneath the bedclothes. and at night we would heat bricks on the stove and wrap them in flannel and put them in the bed to keep our toes from turning to icicles. And the water in our basin was so cold that it would send the pain shooting up my arms when washing my hands. And I was glad we were two in a bed. But Mary said this was nothing, as the real winter was not here, and it would get much colder yet. And the only good of it was that they would have to build up the fires in the house and burn them longer. And it was better to be a servant in the daytime at least, because we could always warm ourselves in the kitchen, whereas the drawing-room was as draughty as a barn, and you could get no heat from the fireplace unless you stood right next to it. And Mrs. Alderman Parkinson lifted her skirts in front of it when alone in the room to warm her backside. And last winter she set her petticoats alight, and Agnes, the chambermaid, heard the shouting and rushed in and was frightened into hysterics. And Mrs. Alderman Parkinson had a blanket thrown over her and was rolled on the floor like a barrel by Jim from the stables. Luckily she was not burnt, but merely singed a little. In the middle of December my father sent my poor sister Katie to beg more of my wages. He would not come himself. I felt sorry for Katie, as the burden that had once been on me was now on her, and I brought her into the kitchen and warmed her by the stove, and asked a piece of bread from cook, who said it was not her job to feed all of the starving orphans in the town, but gave it nevertheless. And Katie cried, and said she wished I was at home again. And I gave her a quarter of a dollar, and said she was to tell our father it was all I had, which I'm sorry to say was a lie. But I had come to feel that the truth was not a thing I owed him. And I gave her 10 cents for herself, and said she was to keep it safe in case of need, though she was in need enough already. Also I gave her a petticoat of mine that was grown too small. She said our father had found no steady work, only odd jobs, but had the prospect of going north that winter to cut trees, and had news of some free land farther west, and would go there once the spring had come. Which he did, and suddenly, too. For Mrs. Burt came around and said my father had gone off without paying anywhere near all he owed. At first she wanted me to make it good, but Mary told her she could not force a girl of 13 to pay a debt incurred by a grown man, and Mrs. Burt was not a bad woman at heart. And at the end she said it was not my fault. I do not know what became of my father and the children. I never had a letter, and also heard nothing from them at the time of the trial. As Christmas time came around, spirits rose, and the fires were built up larger, and hampers were delivered from the grocer, and great wedges of beef, and the carcass of a pig from the butcher, which was to be roasted whole, and bustling preparations were made in the kitchen, and Mary and I were called away from the laundry to give a hand, and we stirred and mixed for cook, and peeled and sliced the apples, and picked through the raisins and currants, and grated the nutmegs, and beat up the eggs as required, and we liked this very much, as there was a chance for a taste here and a nibble there, and whenever we could we scraped off a little sugar for ourselves, and cook did not notice or say anything, as she had a great deal on her mind. It was Mary and me who made the bottom crusts for all of the mince pies, although cook did the top ones, as she said there was an art to it which we were too young to know, and she cut out stars for them and other fancy designs. And she let us unwrap the Christmas cakes from the layers of muslin around them and pour on the brandy and whiskey and wrap them up again, and the smell of it was one of the best things I can remember. There were many pies and cakes needed, as it was the season of visiting and of dinners and parties and balls. The two sons of the household came home from school at Harvard in Boston. Their names were Mr. George and Mr. Richard, and both seemed pleasant enough and fairly tall. I did not pay much attention to them, as to my mind they only made for more washing and a great many more shirts to be starched and ironed. But Mary was always peeping out the upstairs window into the yard to see if she could catch a glimpse of them as they rode away on their horses, or else listening in the passageway while they sang duets with the ladies invited. And what she liked especially was The Rose of Tralee, because her name was in it, where it says, "Oh, no, 'twas the truth in her eye ever dawning that made me love Mary, the Rose of Tralee." She had a good singing voice herself, too, and knew many of the songs off by heart, which the two of them would sometimes come into the kitchen and tease her to sing. And she called them young scamps, although both of them were some years older than she was. On Christmas Day itself, Mary gave me a pair of warm mittens which she'd knitted. I'd seen her doing it, but she'd been very sly and told me they were for a young friend of hers, and I never thought that the young friend she meant was myself. They were a beautiful dark blue, with red flowers embroidered on them, and I gave her a needle case I'd made from 5 squares of red flannel, sewn together along the top, and it tied shut with 2 bits of ribbon. And Mary thanked me, and gave me a hug and a kiss, and said it was the best needle case in the world. You could never buy such a thing in the store, and she'd never seen one like it, and she would treasure it always. The snow had fallen heavily that day, and the people were out in their sleighs with bells on the horses, and it sounded very pretty. And after the family had eaten their Christmas dinner, the servants ate theirs, and had their own turkey and mince pies, and we sang some carols together and were glad. This was the happiest Christmas that I ever spent, either before or after. Mr. Richard went back to school after the holidays, but Mr. George stayed at home. He'd caught a chill which had gone to his lungs and was coughing a great deal, and Mr. and Mrs. Alderman Parkinson went about with long faces, and the doctor came, which alarmed me. But it was said he did not have consumption, only a feverish cold and the lumbago, and must be kept quiet and given hot drinks, and these he had in plentiful supply, as he was a great favorite with the servants. And Mary heated an iron button on the stove, which she said was the best thing for the lumbago if you put it on the spot, and she took it up to him. By the time he was better, it was the middle of February, and he'd missed so much of the college term he said he would stay away until the next one. And Mrs. Alderman Parkinson agreed, and said he needed to build up his strength. And so there he was, being fussed over by all, and with time on his hands and not much he needed to do, which is a bad situation for a young man full of spirits. And there was no shortage of parties to go to, and girls to dance with, and their mothers to plan his wedding for him without his knowledge. I'm afraid he was very much indulged, not least by himself. For if the world treats you well, sir, you come to believe you're deserving of it. Mary had told the truth about the winter. The snow at Christmas time had been heavy, but it was like a blanket of feathers, and the air appeared warmer after it had fallen, and the stable hands joked and threw snowballs, but as they were soft, they broke when they hit. But soon the real winter set in, and the snow began to come down in earnest. This time it was not soft, but hard, like tiny stinging pellets of ice, and it was driven along by a keen and bitter wind, and piled up in thick drifts, and I feared we would all be buried alive. Icicles grew on the roof, and you had to be careful when passing underneath, as they could fall off, and were sharp and pointed, and Mary had heard of a woman who'd been killed by one, that went right through her body like a skewer. One day there was sleet, which covered all the tree branches with a coating of ice, and the next day they sparkled in the sun like 1,000 diamonds. But the trees were weighted down by it, and many branches broke. And the entire world was hard and white. And when the sun shone, it was so blinding that you had to shield your eyes and not look at it too long. We kept indoors as much as possible, as there is a danger of frostbite, especially in the fingers and toes. And the men went about with scarves tied over their ears and noses, and their breath came out in clouds. The family had their fur rugs in the sleigh, and their wraps and cloaks, and went visiting. But we did not have such warm garments. At night Mary and I put our shawls on top of the bed covers, and wore our stockings and an extra petticoat to bed, though even so we were not warm. By morning the fires had died down, and our hot bricks had cooled, and we were shivering like rabbits. On the last day of February the weather improved somewhat, and we ventured out on errands, having wrapped up our feet well in flannel cloths, inside the boots which we begged from the stable hands. And we wound ourselves in as many shawls as we could find or borrow, and walked down as far as the harbor. It was frozen solid, with great blocks and slices of ice piled against the shore, and there was a place cleared of snow where the ladies and gentlemen were skating. It was a graceful motion, as if the ladies were running on wheels underneath their dresses, and I said to Mary that it must be delightful. Mr. George was there, gliding over the ice hand in hand with a young lady in a fur scarf, and he saw us and gave a cheerful wave. I asked Mary if she had ever skated, and she said no. About this time, I began to notice a change in Mary. She was often late coming to bed, and when she did come, she no longer wanted to talk. She did not hear what I said to her, but appeared to be listening to something else, and she was constantly looking out through doorways or windows or over my shoulder. One night, when she thought I was asleep, I saw her hiding something away in a handkerchief, underneath the floorboard where she kept her candle ends and matches, and when I looked the next day, she being out of the room, I found that it was a gold ring. My first thought was that she had stolen it, which would be more than she'd ever stolen before, and very bad for her if she was caught, though there was no talk in the house of a missing ring. But she did not laugh and fun as before, nor did she attend to her work in her usual brisk manner, and I became worried. And when I questioned her and asked if there was some trouble, she would laugh and say she did not know where I was getting such ideas. But her smell had changed, from nutmegs to salt fish. The snow and ice began to melt, and a few birds returned, and they began to sing and call, so I knew it would soon be spring. And one day, in late March, as we were carrying the clean wash up the back stairs in baskets to hang it out in the drying room, Mary said she was ill, and she ran downstairs and out into the backyard behind the outbuildings. I set down my basket and followed her, just as I was, without my shawl, and I found her on her knees in the wet snow near the privy, which she had not had time to reach, as she had been overcome by a violent sickness. I helped her up, and her forehead was damp and clammy, and I said she should be put to bed, but at that she became angry and said it was something she'd eaten. It must have been yesterday's mutton stew, and now she was rid of it. But I'd eaten the very same thing myself and felt perfectly well. She made me promise not to speak of it, and I said I would not. But when the same thing happened a few days later, and then again the next morning, I was truly alarmed, for I'd seen my own mother in that condition very often, and I knew the milky smell of it, and I was well aware what was wrong with Mary. I thought it over, and turned it this way and that in my mind, and towards the end of April I taxed her with it, and swore very solemnly that if she would confide in me I would not tell, for I believed she was in great need of confiding in someone, as she was restless at night, and had dark circles beneath her eyes, and was oppressed by the burden of her secret. Then she broke down and cried, and said my suspicions were all too true, and the man had promised to marry her, and had given her a ring, and for once in a way she'd believed him, as she'd thought he was not like other men. But he'd gone back on his promise, and now would not speak with her, and she was in despair and did not know what to do. I asked her who the man was, but she would not tell me, and she said that as soon as it was known what sort of trouble she was in, she would be turned away, as Mrs. Alderman Parkinson had very strict views, and then what would happen to her? Some girls in her place would have gone back to their families, but she had none, and now no decent man would marry her, and she would have to go on to the streets and become a sailor's drab, as she would have no other way of feeding herself and the baby, and such a life would soon be the end of her. I was very distressed on her behalf, and also on mine, for she was the truest and indeed the only friend I had in the world. I comforted her the best way I could, but I did not know what to say. Throughout the month of May, Mary and I frequently talked about what she should do. I said there must be a workhouse or something of the sort that would take her in, and she said she knew of none, but even so, if young girls went to any such place, they always died, as they got fever as soon as they were delivered, and she believed the babies in such places were secretly smothered so as not to be a charge on the public purse, and she would sooner take her chances of dying elsewhere. We talked about some way of delivering the baby ourselves and keeping it quiet and giving it away as an orphan, but she said her condition would soon begin to show, and Mrs. Honey had very sharp eyes, and had already remarked that Mary was putting on flesh, and she could not hope to go long undetected. I said she should try one last time to speak with the man in question and appeal to his better nature, and she did so. But when she returned from the interview, which must have taken place nearby as she was not gone long, she was angrier than she had ever been. She said he'd given her $5, and she'd said was that all his child was worth to him, and he said she would not catch him that way, and he doubted that it was even his own child, since she'd been so obliging with him that he suspected she had been so for others, and if she threatened him with a scandal or went to his family, he would deny it, and ruin whatever reputation she had left, and if she wanted a quick end to her troubles, she could always drown herself. She said she had once truly loved him, but did so no longer. And she threw the $5 on the floor and cried passionately for an hour. But I noticed her putting the money carefully away under the loose board afterwards. The next Sunday, she said she would not go to church but for a walk by herself. And when she came back, she said she'd gone down to the harbor with the idea of throwing herself into the lake and putting an end to her life. And I begged her with tears not to do such a wicked thing. 2 days later, she said she'd been over to Lombard Street and had heard there of a doctor who could help her. He was the doctor that the whores went to when they needed it. I asked her in what way he might help, and she said I shouldn't ask, and I did not know what she meant, having never heard of such doctors. And she asked if I would lend her my savings, which amounted at that time to $3, which I'd been intending for a new summer dress, and I said I would lend it to her with all my heart. She then brought out a piece of writing paper, which she'd obtained from the library downstairs, and a pen and ink, and she wrote, "If I die, my things are to go to Grace Marks," and she signed it with her name. And then she said, "Soon I may be dead, but you will still be alive." And she gave me a cold and resentful look, such as I'd seen her give to others behind their backs, but never to me. I was much alarmed at this, and clutched her hand, and begged her not to go to this doctor, whoever he might be. But she said she must, and I was not to carry on, but I must put the pen and ink back secretly on the writing desk in the library and go about my duties. And tomorrow she would steal away after the midday meal, and I was to say, if asked, that she'd just gone out to the privy, or that she was up in the drawing-room, or any excuse that came into my head, and then I was to slip away and join her, as she might be in difficulties coming home. Neither one of us slept well that night, and the next day she did as she said she would, and managed to leave the house without detection, with the money knotted up in her handkerchief, and I followed soon after and joined her. The doctor lived in a large enough house in a good neighborhood. We went in by the servants' entrance, and the doctor himself met us. The first thing he did was to count the money. He was a big man in a black coat and looked at us very severely, and he told me to wait in the scullery, and then said that if I told anything about it, he would deny ever having seen me. And then he took off his frock coat and hung it on a hook, and began rolling up his shirt sleeves, as if for a fight. He looked very similar, sir, to the head-measuring doctor that frightened me into a fit just before you came here. Mary went with him out of the room, her face white as a sheet, and then I heard screams and crying, and after a time the doctor pushed her in through the scullery door. Her dress was all damp and clinging to her like a wet bandage, and she could scarcely walk, and I put my arms around her and assisted her away from that place as best I could. When we reached the house, she was bent nearly double and holding her hands to her stomach, and said, "Would I help her upstairs?" Which I did, and she seemed very weak. I put her into her nightdress and into the bed, and she kept her petticoat on, crumpled up between her legs. And I asked her what had happened, and she said, "The doctor took a knife to her and cut something inside, and he said there would be pain and bleeding, and it would last some hours, but that after this she would be all right again." And she'd given a false name. It began to dawn on me that what the doctor had cut out of her was the baby, which I thought a most wicked thing. But I also thought it was either one corpse that way or two the other, because if not, she would certainly have drowned herself, so I could not find it within my heart to reproach her. She was in great pain, and in the evening I warmed a brick and carried it upstairs, but she would not let me fetch anyone. And I said I would sleep on the floor, she would be more comfortable that way. And she said I was the best friend she ever had, and that whatever happened, she would never forget me. I rolled myself up in my shawl, with my apron for a pillow, and lay down on the floor, which was very hard. And what with that, and with Mary's groans of agony, I could not sleep at first. But after a time it grew quieter, and I fell asleep, and did not wake up until daybreak. And when I did, there was Mary, dead, in the bed, with her eyes wide open and staring. I touched her, but she was cold. I stood stock still with fear, but then I roused myself and went along the hall and woke Agnes, the chambermaid, and fell into her arms weeping, and she said, "Whatever is the matter?" I could not speak, but took her by the hand and led her into our room to where Mary was. Agnes laid hold of her and shook her by the shoulder, and then she said, "Good heavens, she is dead." And I said, Oh, Agnes, what shall I do? I did not know she was going to die, and now they will blame me for not telling sooner that she was taken ill. But she made me promise not to, and I was sobbing and wringing my hands. Agnes lifted the bed covers and looked beneath. The nightdress and petticoat were soaked through with blood, and the sheet was all red with it, and brown where it had dried. She said, "This is a bad business," and she told me to stay there, and she went at once to fetch Mrs. Honey. I heard her footsteps going away, and it seemed to me she was gone a long time. I sat on the chair in our room and looked at Mary's face. Her eyes were open, and I could feel her looking back at me out of the corners of her eyes. I thought I saw her move, and I said, "Mary, are you pretending?" For she sometimes pretended she was dead, behind the sheets in the drying room to frighten me. But she was not pretending. Then I heard two sets of footsteps hurrying along the passage, and I was filled with dread. But I stood up, and Mrs. Honey came into the room. She did not look sad, she looked angry, and also disgusted, as if she could smell a bad smell, and there was indeed a smell in the room. It was the smell of wet straw from the mattress, and also the salty smell of blood. You can smell something very similar in a butcher's shop. And Mrs. Honey said, "This is an outrage and a disgrace. I must go and tell Mrs. Parkinson." And we waited, and Mrs. Alderman Parkinson came and said, "Under my own roof, what a deceitful girl." And she looked straight at me, although she was talking about Mary. Then she said, "Why did you not inform me of this, Grace?" And I said, "Please, ma'am, Mary told me not to. She said she would be better in the morning." And I started to cry, and I said, "I did not know she was going to die." Agnes, who was very pious, as I have told you, said, "The wages of sin is death." Mrs. Alderman Parkinson said, "That was wicked of you, Grace." And Agnes said, "She's only a child. She is very obedient. She was just doing as she was told." I thought Mrs. Alderman Parkinson would scold her for interfering, but she did not. She took hold of my arm gently and looked into my eyes and said, "Who was the man? The scoundrel should be exposed and made to pay for his crime. I suppose it was some sailor down at the harbor. They have no more conscience than a flea. Do you know, Grace?" I said, "Mary did not know any sailors. She was seeing a gentleman, and they were engaged. Only he broke his promise and would not marry her." And Mrs. Alderman Parkinson said sharply, "What gentleman?" I said, "Please, ma'am, I don't know. Only she said you would not like it at all if you found out who it was." Mary had not said this, but I had my own suspicions. At that, Mrs. Alderman Parkinson looked thoughtful and paced to and fro the length of the room, and then she said, "Agnes and Grace, we will not discuss this further, as it will only lead to unhappiness and added misery, and there is no sense in crying over spilt milk. And out of respect for the dead, we will not say what Mary died of. We will say it was a low fever. That will be best for all." And she looked at both of us very hard, and we curtsied. And all the time Mary was there on the bed listening to us, and hearing about our plans to tell these lies about her, and I thought, she will not be easy in her mind about it. I didn't say anything about the doctor, and they did not ask. Perhaps they didn't even consider such a thing. They must have thought it was only a lost baby, as women frequently have, and that Mary had died of it, as women frequently did. And you are the first person I have told about the doctor, sir. But it is my true belief that it was the doctor that killed her with his knife, him and the gentleman between them. For it is not always the one that strikes the blow that is the actual murderer. And Mary was done to death by that unknown gentleman as surely as if he'd taken the knife and plunged it into her body himself. Mrs. Alderman Parkinson left the room, and after a while Mrs. Honey came and said we were to take the sheet from the bed and her nightdress and petticoat, and wash the blood out of them, and wash the body, and take the mattress to be burnt and to see to it ourselves. And there was another mattress cover beside where the quilts were stored, and we could stuff that with straw, and we were to fetch a clean sheet. She asked if there was another nightdress for Mary to be dressed in, and I said there was, because Mary had two, but the other one was in the wash. Then I said I would give her one of mine. She said we were not to tell anyone of Mary's death until we'd got her looking presentable, with a quilt pulled up over her and her eyes closed and her hair combed and tidy. Then she went out of the room, and Agnes and myself did as she said, and Mary was light to lift. but heavy to arrange. Then Agnes said, "There is more to this than meets the eye, and I wonder who the man was." And she looked at me, and I said, "Whoever he is still alive and well, and most likely enjoying his breakfast at this very moment, and not having any thoughts in his head about poor Mary, no more than if she was a carcass hung up at the butcher's." Agnes said, "It is the curse of Eve, which we must all bear." And I knew Mary would have laughed at that. And then I heard her voice, as clear as anything, right in my ear, saying, "Let me in." I was quite startled, and looked hard at Mary, who by that time was lying on the floor as we were making up the bed. But she gave no sign of having said anything, and her eyes were still open and staring up at the ceiling. Then I thought with a rush of fear, but I did not open the window, and I ran across the room and opened it, because I must have heard wrong, and she was saying, "Let me out." Agnes said, "What are you doing? It's as cold as an icicle out there." And I said, "The smell is making me sick." And she agreed that the room should be aired. I was hoping Mary's soul would fly out the window now and not stay inside whispering things into my ear, but I wondered whether I was too late. Finally, we had all done, and I had bundled the sheet and the nightdress together and took them down to the laundry and pumped a tub full of cold water, because it's the cold water you need to get out the blood, as the hot will set it. By good fortune, the laundress was not in the laundry, but in the main kitchen, heating the irons for the ironing and gossiping with cook. And I scrubbed, and much of the blood came out, making the water all red. And I ran that down the drain and pumped another tubful, and left the things to soak with some vinegar poured in to help with the smell. Whether from the cold or the shock, my teeth by now were chattering. And as I ran back up the stairs, I felt quite dizzy. Agnes had been waiting in the room with Mary, all nicely laid out now, with her eyes closed as if sleeping, and her hands crossed on her breast. I told Agnes what I'd done, and she sent me to tell Mrs. Alderman Parkinson that all was ready. And I did, and went back upstairs. And pretty soon here came the servants to see, crying, some of them, and sad-faced, as was fitting. But still there is always a strange excitement around a death, and I could see that the blood was flowing more strongly through their veins than on ordinary days. Agnes did the talking, and said it was a sudden fever, and for a woman as pious as she was, she lied very well. And I stood by Mary's feet, keeping silent, and one said, "Poor Grace, to wake up in the morning and find her cold and stark in the bed beside you with no warning at all." And another said, "It makes your flesh creep to think of it. My own nerves would never stand it." Then it was as if that had really happened. I could picture it, the waking up with Mary in the bed right beside me, and touching her, and finding she would not speak to me, and the horror and distress I would feel. And at that moment, I fell to the floor in a dead faint. They said I lay like that for 10 hours, and no one could wake me, though they tried pinching and slapping and cold water and burning feathers under my nose, and that when I did wake up, I did not seem to know where I was or what had happened, and I kept asking where Grace had gone. And when they told me that I myself was Grace, I would not believe them, but cried and tried to run out of the house because I said that Grace was lost and had gone into the lake and I needed to search for her. They told me later they'd feared for my reason, which must have been unsettled by the shock of it all, and it was no wonder, considering. Then I fell again into a deep sleep. When I woke, it was a day later, and I knew again that I was Grace, and that Mary was dead. And I remembered the night we'd thrown the apple peelings over our shoulders, and Mary's had broken 3 times, and it had all come true, as she had not married anyone at all, and now never would. But I had no memory of anything I said or did during the time I was awake, between the 2 long sleeps, and this worried me. And so the happiest time of my life was over and gone. 7. Snake Fence. McDermott was morose and churlish. There was very little to admire in his character. He was a smart young fellow, so lithe that he would run along the top of a zigzag fence like a squirrel, or leap over a 5-barred gate rather than open or climb it. Grace was of a lively disposition and pleasant manners, and may have been an object of jealousy to Nancy, There is plenty of room for the supposition that instead of her being the instigator and promoter of the terrible deeds committed, she was but the unfortunate dupe in the whole dreadful business. There certainly did not appear to be anything in the girl's personality that would be likely to develop into an embodiment of concentrated iniquity that McDermott tried to make her out to have been, if he ever uttered one half of the statements attributed to him in his confession. His disregard for truth was well known. William Harrison, Recollections of the Kinnear Tragedy, written for the Newmarket Era, 1908. Yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterwards remember, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thoughts that once I had, better by far you should forget and smile, than that you should remember and be sad. Christina Rossetti, Remember, 1849. Simon takes his hat and stick from the governor's wife's maid and staggers out into the sunlight. It's too bright for him, too harsh, as if he's been closed up in a dark room for a long time, although the sewing room is far from dark. It's Grace's story that is dark. He feels as if he's just come from an abattoir. Why has this account of death affected him so strongly? Of course, he's known that such things happen. Such doctors do exist. And it isn't as if he's never seen a dead woman. He's seen a great many of them. But they have been so thoroughly dead. They have been specimens. He has never caught them, as it were, in the act. This Mary Whitney, not yet, what, 17? A young girl. Deplorable. He would like to wash his hands. No doubt about it. The turn of events has caught him off guard. He'd been following her story with, he has to admit, a certain personal pleasure. He has his own happier days and memories of them, and they too contain pictures of clean sheets and joyful holidays and cheerful young maidservants. And then, at the center of it, this dire surprise. She'd lost her memory, too, though only for some hours, and during a normal enough fit of hysterics, but still, it may prove significant. It is the only memory she seems to have forgotten, so far. Otherwise, every button and candle end seems accounted for. But on second thought, he has no way of knowing that, and he has an uneasy sense that the very plenitude of her recollections may be a sort of distraction, a way of drawing the mind away from some hidden but essential fact, like the dainty flowers planted over a grave. Also, he reminds himself, the only witness who could corroborate her testimony, if this were a court of law, would be Mary Whitney herself, and she is not available. Down the driveway to the left comes Grace herself, walking with her head lowered, flanked by two unsavory-looking men he supposes to be prison guards. They're leaning very close to her, as if she's no murderess, but a precious treasure to be kept safe. He doesn't like the way they press up against her, but of course their lives would be very difficult if she were to escape, although he's always known that she's taken back every evening and locked into a narrow cell. Today it strikes him as incongruous. They've been talking together all afternoon as if in a parlor, and now he is free as air and may do whatever he likes, while she must be bolted and barred, caged in a dreary prison. Deliberately dreary, for if a prison were not dreary, where would be the punishment? Even the word punishment grates on him today. He can't get Mary Whitney out of his mind, lying in her winding sheet of blood. He has stayed longer than usual this afternoon. In half an hour he is due at the Reverend Verringer's for an early supper. He does not feel hungry in the least. He decides to walk along by the lake shore. The breeze there will do him good and possibly restore his appetite. It's just as well, he reflects, that he didn't continue as a surgeon. The most fearsome of his instructors at Guy's Hospital in London, the celebrated Dr. Bransby Cooper, used to say that for a good surgeon, as for a good sculptor, the ability to detach oneself from the business at hand was a prerequisite. A sculptor should not allow himself to be distracted by the transient charms of his model, but should regard her objectively, as merely the base material or clay from which his work of art was to be formed. Similarly, a surgeon was a sculptor of flesh. He should be able to slice into a human body as deliberately and as delicately as if carving a cameo. A cold hand and a steady eye were what was required. Those who felt too deeply for the patient's suffering were the ones in whose fingers the knife slipped. The afflicted did not need your compassion, but your skill. All very